Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai
Jai Guru Jai
Guru Jai, Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai, Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai, Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai Guru Jai, Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai, Paramahansa Yogananda Jai Guru Jai.
Beloved Guru,
Beloved Guru,
Paramahansa Yogananda Ji,
saints of all religions,
we humbly bow to you.
Beloved Lord,
we feel your soul call,
drawing us to thee.
Help us make our pilgrimage,
into thy arms.
Guide us and bless us
along our way.
We are thine.
Be thou ours.
Om. Peace.
Amen.
Amen. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our Inner Renewal Week. If there's a seat by you, please raise your hand because I can see there's people are coming in at this time. Well, we want to welcome. We're going to use that. We want to welcome all of you, and we have people who have come quite a distance from New York and Rhode Island and Maine and. Many of our communities throughout America, and we have people joining us through our live streaming internet all over the world. So it's an interesting experience in this Dwapara Yuga, how there really is no space. And this little point where we all are residing right now, it's everywhere. Just as Master said, God is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. And so it is with these teachings. Whenever we share them, whenever we talk about the great blessings that Master gave us, we're speaking on a place of timelessness and spacelessness, and we invite you during this week to try to dwell in that space. Try to let go of all your worries and preoccupations and what you're going to do next week. Jyotish and I are flying to India next week, so trying not to think about packing. But let's just dwell in this moment, the eternal now. And in preparation for that, we're going to do something that is from a timeless, spaceless experience, the blowing of the conch.
As you know from the Bhagavad Gita, the conch represents the call of the Pandavas, which represent the chakras. So this is the sound of the chakras calling us within.
We thought we'd start this morning with a chant and a brief meditation because we want to go inward with this week.
Door of my heart. Lord, will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Night and day, I look for thee, night and day, night and day.
Let's meditate briefly.
Shanti.
There's a chair up here, although not for the faint at heart. So this morning, the topic is the inner pilgrimage. And instead of talking about an inner pilgrimage, I thought what I would do this morning is to share the experience of the inner pilgrimage. So I'll share with you the experience of my inner pilgrimage. Now, I've thought about this some, and when I think back, time gets really stretchy. So I don't know whether I'm sharing a whole lifetime or whether I'm sharing a year or a single meditation or an amalgamation of all meditations. At any rate, here's how it happened. I had studied some, I had read some of spiritual literature, and I was interested in somehow taking a pilgrimage, an inner pilgrimage. And I'd looked at Zen Path, and that seemed a little dry for me, and I'd looked at other ones. Then I found a pilgrimage called The Path that had to do with Yogananda. And it was supposed to take you to the ocean of bliss. Well, that sounded good to me, so I figured, I think I'll do that one. There was a brochure on it, and it gave you a certain little hints that said along the path there wouldn't be any use for credit cards or money, but you could bring money and exchange it for tokens, which could be used along the path. And so I did that, and I had in my mind that this path was going to be, I don't know, something like the Pacific Coast Trail or Camino de Santiago or some of those famous pilgrimages that you take to holy places. But I figured I'd better pack light. So I'd done my research, and I'd gotten a little tiny stove, you know, and the sleeping bag and the nice backpack and the good walking shoes. And so I showed up at the entrance, which I thought was going to be a trailhead. But it was completely different from that. It was like coming to Disneyland. There was this big kind of village there with lights and shiny things, and there was a place you could exchange your money for tokens, and I'd saved up a few $100s, and I got my tokens, and there were others, and they must have been more concerned because they were exchanging thousands of dollars. And so we came inside, and just kind of like Disneyland, you know, that entrance where it's kind of a village. It looked a little hokey to me because I wasn't expecting it to be that way. But then we started off, and there were carts there. So if you wanted to carry things, some people came with the backpacks, and others had little carts and medium-sized carts and big carts. You could push those along, and some people were roller bags. It was really a mixture. And there was this one fellow, kind of a big, heavy fellow, red-faced, and he had somehow managed to put four carts together, all piled with goods in them. And he was pushing that rig along. And so we started out, and it was a beautiful day. The path was wide and paved, and everybody was going along having a good time. And we were, you know, I was walking along and others were
dressed kind of like me, and some were pushing carts, and of course there was this big fellow. And then I saw this one man kind of going, and he was helping push carts. And he didn't have any backpack at all. All he had was slacks and a t-shirt. And on the back of the t-shirt, it said plain living. And on the front of the t-shirt, it said high thinking. And he had a pair of sandals. And he was dressed really lightly. So he was going along helping people push their carts and pull their bags. And so we were walking along, and I don't know, mid-morning, he noticed that I'd been kind of looking at him out of the corner of my eye. So he came over, and he introduced himself. He said, "I'm Walker." Now, there wasn't too much talking on this path. They kind of discouraged it. There was a sign that said, "Please keep silence unless you have... Please do not speak unless whatever you have to say improves upon the silence." And so mostly it was being ignored, but people were not talking too much. So this man came over and he introduced himself and he said his name was Walker. And I didn't know whether that was, you know, one of these handles that you get along the trail or his real name, whatever. And he said, "You want to help me push some carts?" And I kind of looked at him, and I guess he saw that I was a little hesitant. And so he said, "You'll be happier if you do." And so I figured, well, what have I got to lose? So I said, "Sure, I'll help you push some carts." And so we were moving along, and everything was, as I say, it was a beautiful day, smooth path, easy. Then we came to a slight upslope, and that upslope made it harder for the people, especially the guy with the four-cart rig, you know, I mean, he was really struggling up there. But after some time, it kind of leveled out again. And then as evening came, we came to a guest house, and I kind of was expecting that we were going to camp along the path, you know. But here was this gorgeous guest house with lots of rooms, and the rooms were kind of like a, you know, those locker rooms where if there's a key in the door, you just go and open it and that's yours. Well, it was like that. So you just got your room, beautiful pool, and it was just really nice. And then time came for us to go into the dining room, and gorgeous buffet. I mean, every possible salad that you could think of, salad ingredients and fruits and vegetables, and they even had a section for meat for those who ate meat. But then there was a sign that said, "Room and board and access to the store, 10%. And everybody kind of looked around, well, what in the world does that mean? And then we figured it out. You had to give 10% of your tokens for room and board, and seemed a little high to me, but I went ahead and did it. But you can imagine, I mean, I'd only changed a few hundred dollars. Those people who had exchanged thousands of dollars, they had to give 10%. And they were really, I mean, that was really upsetting to them. And, you know, they were not used to giving a tithe. And so they kind of gathered around and they were talking and griping and moaning, and a group of them, in fact, decided that they were not going to go along with this. They were not going to give any 10%, and that they saw that there was a tea room. At least you could get tea for free. And so they went in that tea room and they had kind of a party in there, kind of an angry... angry party, and they were making a lot of noise, and that went on all night. Anyway, we came back, and in the morning, they were kind of had formed this group, and they were trying to convince everybody that this whole thing was a scam, a plot to get your money. One of them must have seen this fellow Walker because he had penned on his t-shirt, "Plain Thinking and High Living." And then there was a group of them, and overnight they'd obviously decided that they were going to try to convince us not to go on. And they'd thought up a really nifty slogan that they were going around, and they were very serious, and this slogan was going to convince, and it did convince some people. And it was, "What is wisdom if not to keep what is ours for ourselves?" And so a lot of people turned back that first day. But then the part came for free access to the store. And I thought it would be, you know, a little mom and pop shop where you could get some trail mix or power bars or something. But I went in and it was like a Walmart. I mean, it was huge. It had a furniture section. It had appliances. It had carts that you could get. Well, you can imagine the fellow with the four-cart rig. He had really piled it up. But then there was a sign that said, "Feel free to use whatever you want. Return it when you're done." And then there was a little note saying, "Return station, 1/2 mile. So everybody was, well, not everybody. A lot of people were piling up their cart. And started off, but I got a few power bars because I wanted to travel light. And so started off, and then it was the first time that I realized that the management for this place had a kind of a dark sense of humor. Because you went out the store and around a bend, and then there was the return station, and it was right at the base of a long flight of stairs. And so obviously, nobody was going to take their carts up the stairs. So everybody was returning everything that they'd gotten in the store. Well, almost everybody. The fellow with the four-rig cart, he had two pull bags. He had a backpack, but he'd swung it around so that it was on his front. And believe it or not, he had a plasma TV strapped to his back. And I think even he was a little embarrassed. I came up and I looked at him because he had a cap on that said San Francisco 49ers. And I kind of looked at him quizzically and he gave this little smile. He said, "The TV's for next year's Super Bowl." And so we went on, and that was the last time I ever saw that guy. I don't know whether he made it or not. But after the flight of stairs, it kind of leveled off. And so we walked. And each night, as we walked, you came to a guest house. Of course, they got smaller because people were turning back. But you came to the guest house, and still, beautiful buffet, beautiful, everything you wanted. Of course, the stores now were just kind of more minimalist, but you could get whatever you wanted. But always still 10%. Room and board, 10%. Sign said, "Take whatever you want. Please return it when you're done." And so that went on. And it was, I think it was the third day. No, it was the fourth day. I was standing in line because, you know, there'd be a line going in where people were kind of counting out their remaining tokens and figuring out 10%. And then there was another entrance that said, "For those who want to give more." And I'd ignored it all along, but no, of course, nobody was lining up there much. And I was in the line, and I was counting out my 10%, and then I started chuckling. So I stepped aside, and I was kind of laughing, and I thought, huh, there's a trick to this. And Walker came over, and he said, "Did you figure it out?" And I said, I think so. He said, well, that's good. And I said, what did you do when you figured it out? He said, well, I upped my tithe. And I said, well, how much? He said, all the way. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? So I went over to this line that said, for those who want to give more. And I took my little purse and I threw the whole thing in there. I gave 100%. Because what I'd figured out was after you'd given 100%, you could keep giving 100% all the time. And so Walker and I, we were the only two that went through that line. But after that, I think others got the idea, and more and more people followed along that way. So then we kept walking and walking, and day by day, kind of, I don't know, the burdens fell off, the packs got lighter, and a group of people started walking along with Walker. And so we would stop at night, and sometimes he would sing songs, and sometimes he would, it was obvious that he had walked the path before. Sometimes he would talk about that, talk about the attitudes of success on the path. Sometimes he would teach us some techniques. And gradually, we walked along and people just got lighter and lighter, not just the packs, but kind of mentally and emotionally, things seemed to fall off. And as they fell off, you just got happier and happier along the path. And there were other people, lots of other people walking who didn't want to walk with us, but we were open to anyone joining that wanted to. And so people would come and they would join, and there was one fellow who was had joined a couple of days earlier, and he still had a pack that he was carrying, but somebody came up and asked him if they could join. He said, well, you can join, but we travel light and we travel fast. And while it was true, it sounded like the line out of an old John Wayne movie or something, you know, but pretty soon he was along and he'd dropped most of his stuff with his pack. And every night you'd come and there was a place to stop. And they tended now to be more little tents and campfires than these big kind of gaudy guest house that was like the first one we stopped at. And as people went along, I noticed that they began to drop off things that they had been clutching to themselves. I saw one woman who had been writing in a journal all the time, and every night along the way, writing in a journal. And then I saw one morning as we were walking along that she had thrown the journal aside, and I saw the cover. It said regrets. And there was another person who had these plans, and every night they were plans for what he was going to build when he got to the end of the pilgrimage. And he worked on them and worked on them. Then one night I saw him use the plans to light the campfire. And there was a woman who had a big photo album, and it had pictures of her kids and family and her grandparents and great-grandparents and loved ones and people who'd passed away. And it was obviously really precious to her. But then one day, walking along, I saw that she had put that little album there and made a little shrine with flowers and left that behind. And then the last thing I noticed was floating down, we were then walking by a little stream, and floating down the stream was one of these journals. And my immediate thought was I ought to grab that and get it out because it's polluting the stream. But then I saw the cover, and the cover said, mistakes I've made. And so I figured it was going to, if I got it out, it was going to pollute the owner a lot worse than it was going to pollute the stream. And so we kept walking along, and this, as I say, time was stretchy. I don't know how long this section took, but it was like this was the first section of the journey. And then we saw people on the other side of this stream, either a river by this time, walking the other direction. And we didn't know why they had turned back. And somebody called out, "Why have you turned back?" And one of them said, "We didn't pass the exam." And we thought, "Exam?" And then there was a sign saying, "Exam ahead, 25 miles. And so we went to Walker because we were nervous. We saw a lot of people coming back. And so we asked him about the exam. He said, "Yeah, there was an exam." He said, "But we haven't been preparing. We haven't been studying for anything." He said, "I don't know. You don't need to study for this one. I think most of you are pretty well prepared." But still, of course, it was nerve-wracking. And so we got to that place, and it started out that there was a kind of a changing room for men and for women. And you went in, and there was a pool there, and soap, and you took off all your clothes, and you scrubbed down, cleaned yourself really well. And then they had steps that led down into this river, and you had to then wade across the river and wade and steps up on the other side. And somehow, I don't know, it felt very, very cleansing. It felt like, I don't know, going into the Ganges or maybe the River Jordan or something like that. But it felt like there was a transition point there where you came out feeling really clean. And of course, you had to leave everything on the other side. And you came out and there were slacks and sandals and t-shirts that said plain living and high thinking. And so we all looked kind of like Walker. And along the way, you didn't use your own names along the path. You kind of got different names. And he had called everybody Pilgrim. Pilgrim. But he had a certain way of intonation in his voice or something. So everybody, even though he called everybody Pilgrim, everybody knew how he pronounced it, that he was referring to you. And some people, he had a little sense of humor too. There was one person who was really annoying, and he tended to call him Pilgrim. And there was another person who was always dour, and he called him Pilgrim. But everybody was Pilgrim. And by the time we got out, all we had were the slacks and the sandals and the t-shirt. And then there was the exam room. And there was a stack of exams. And I don't know whether you've seen the exams that you do in college where they have the blue covers and, you know, the pages of exam questions and kind of a seal on it. So I picked up one, 8.5 by 11, and it looked like there were 15 or 20 pages inside, but I couldn't tell it was sealed. And on the cover, it said, 1, please answer honestly. 2, you may return as often as you like to retake the exam. 3, begin when you hear the conch. And so we went in, and of course, everybody was nervous. Along with the exam was a pencil and a great big, one of those rubber gum erasers, so you could rub out an answer and change it. And so we went in, and then I heard the conch, and I opened up my exam. And at first I thought I got a defective copy because the first page was blank. The other side of it was blank. And then it was blank page and blank page and blank page. And at the very end, on the last page, was one question. You had to answer true or false. And the question was, from now on, I embrace as the only purpose of my life the search for God. True or false? And people were thinking about that, you know, taking it seriously. And a lot of people, especially Walker's group, checked the true box for that. And some people looked at the cover and thought, well, you come back and retake the exam if you want. So they headed back the other way. But then after the exam, the trail, the path, changed in temperament a lot, because then we started coming into the high passes, and it took total focus, because it wasn't so much it was dangerous, it just took all your focus and concentration to walk along the path there. And the first section of that, there was a high cliff on one side, but somehow there was moisture, and the covering of the path there was with clay, and the moisture had made it really, really slippery, almost like ice. And so it was really easy to slide off. Now, it wasn't dangerous, but when you slid off, there was kind of shale, and so you'd tend to slide down this slope, and then it took you a lot of effort and time to kind of clamber back up and get onto the path. And everybody was slipping off and clambering back up. And then I remembered something that Walker had said. He said, when you tend to slip, stay centered in your spine and relax completely. And so he even gave an example of a skier. And so I did that. I got really centered in my spine, and I got completely relaxed. And I found as long as I could maintain that, I didn't slip off anymore. And not only that, but it became kind of fun, because when you hit a down slope, you could kind of slide down. As long as you were centered, you could slide down kind of like a snowboarder without the snowboard, you know? And that section became actually very enjoyable. And then the wall kind of fell away, and the path was still very narrow, and these winds started swirling around and just blowing really hard. And so here you had to not only concentrate, but it was a little bit frightening with these winds. It reminded me of that line from Master's poem, when storms of trials shriek and when worries howl at you, drown their noises loudly chanting, God, God, God. And so I did that. And I was chanting, God, God, God. And it worked. The kind of noises faded away, and any worries or fear faded away. But the winds were still swirling around, still blowing back and forth. And it was very difficult. But then I remembered that Walker, one evening when he taught us this technique of Kriya, he also said something from the Gita. He said that Kriya, the control of the breath and the life force, was like controlling the wind, and that the wind was easier to control than the mind. But I figured, if Kriya could control the mind, maybe it could control the wind too. And so I started doing Kriya as we went along. And sure enough, as long as I was doing Kriya, and as long as I was completely focused, then the winds just quieted down. And the path became actually quite easy. You could move along quite quickly. And then we came to another section where there was like a wall. I don't know if you've ever seen those photos from, I think it's from Arizona, where those sandstone walls go way up and you can see kind of a channel through it. Well, it was like that, except it was kind of this golden yellow sandstone, and the walls started to get really, really narrow. And so the only way you could get through was kind of squeezing yourself through like this and kind of using your hands and feet, because it was like scraping you. It was like at this section, it was scraping away everything, taking you down just to absolutely your core. And so it seemed quite a long time that that went on, that scraping process. And then at the end, you could see that these narrow walls had opened up. And at the end, I still don't know whether it was a natural formation or whether it was man-made, but it ended in a perfect circle. And that perfect circle was the exit. And because the light was outside, it made that yellowish golden sandstone just kind of glow. And then through that circle, you could see the sky. And the sky was a beautiful, beautiful deep blue. And then right in the center, they must have known exactly where to place this, was a pure white star. And so I knew that that was the end of this pilgrimage. And so when you exited there, you came out into this, I can hardly even describe it. It's a beautiful, beautiful valley ringed with mountains. In some ways, it reminded me of that movie Shangri-La. And in other ways, it was, I don't know, Rainbow Falls. And it was kind of like Rivendell or something. Anyway, it was gorgeous. And it was huge, really large. And then the most fun thing of all was that there was this cliff, and there was a suit that you could put on. And as soon as your feet were off the ground, these wings snapped out from the back, and you could soar. And I could see a few others doing that. But it was really scary. And the first time I did that, you know, I went out about as far as to the edge of the room there and came back and landed. And gradually I did that more and more. But then I began to soar. And there was such a sense of freedom and such a sense of joy in that. It's beyond anything that you can even imagine. And so for days and days, I would just soar like that. And after a while, I could see that there were kind of thermals. And a thermal is a column of warm air that's rising. And so you could catch that thermal and kind of circle around like a spiral staircase. And you could go higher and higher and higher and ride those thermals. And as I say, time was stretchy. I don't know how long I stayed there. But one day the thought came to me that no matter how beautiful that was, at the end of the day, I still had to come back and land. And my feet had to touch ground again. And it began to weigh on me a little bit. And I wanted to somehow, I knew there was something more. And so finally one day, I decided, I'd never seen anybody do it, but I decided I was going to try to fly over the mountains. And so I did that. I rode a thermal like higher and higher and higher until I could fly over the mountains. And then kind of the same landscape, more or less, that we had walked along opened up. And from point to point, I could see other thermals rising. You could see them in the distance kind of shimmering as the light changed. So I went from thermal to thermal, but always there was, whether it was a wind or the way that they were arranged, it was like they were taking me back again to where we had started. And so kind of mid-afternoon, I came back And I looked down and I saw the same entrance, the same Disneyland-like entrance to the path. And I saw Walker. And he was there as if waiting for me. And so I landed and he said, "Hi, I've been waiting for you. I wanted to say goodbye." And I said, "Well, why are we back here? Right where we began." And he said, "Well, certainly you didn't think this journey, this pilgrimage, was about taking your body from one point to another." I said, "Yeah, but we're back at the same place." He said, "Well, the place may be the same, but you're not the same." And so I said, "Well, true." And then I said, "Why are you here? What do you mean you're going to say goodbye?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to go on to the next part of the journey." And he said, "On this part of the journey, you can't take anything at all with you, not even your body. Because for this part of the journey, you have to travel at the speed of light." And I said, "Well, can I go with you?" And he said, "If you're ready." And the way he said it, I knew intuitively that I wasn't quite ready. And so then there was a little commotion, some kind of shouting or something at the entrance to the park. And I looked over and caught my attention for a little bit. And then when I looked back, all there was were a pair of sandals and a shirt, a little pile of clothing. And there was a note on it, said, "Use this if you want. Use these clothes if you want. When you're done, pass them along to someone else." And it was signed Walker. First time I'd ever seen him sign his name. But he had this squiggly little handwriting. And the loop of the K, he had crossed that, so it looked like a T. And so I took off the wingsuit, and there was a return station, as always. And I put on these clothing, and the shirt said plain living and high thinking. And I thought, I guess I'll go push some carts. And then I noticed that there was a whole stack of his T-shirts that he'd left there, enough for anybody who wanted to put one on.
That was the best story ever.
Let's just meditate for a few moments and then we'll go on. Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Well, this fellow Walker wrote a lot of books. And he wrote one called The New Path. And I'd like to start by reading from the first chapter of The New Path. "Everyone in this world is a pilgrim. He comes alone, treads his chosen path for a time, then leaves once more solitarily. His is a sacred destination, always dimly suspected, though usually not consciously known. Whether deliberately or by blind instinct, directly or indirectly, what all men are truly seeking is joy. Infinite joy, joy eternal, joy divine. Most of us, alas, wander about in this world like pilgrims without a map. We imagine joy shrine to be wherever money is worshipped, or power, or fame, or good times. It is only after very distant roaming that, disappointed at last, we pause in silent self-appraisal. And then we discover, perhaps with a shock, that our goal was never distant from us at all. Indeed, never any farther away than our own selves. This path we walk has no fixed dimensions. It is either long or short, depending only on the purity of our intentions. It is the path Jesus described when he said, "The kingdom of God cometh not with observation, neither shall they say, 'Lo here,' or 'Lo there,' for behold, the kingdom of God is within you. Walking this path, we yet claim it not, for the goal, being inward, is ours already. We have only to claim it as our own." And so when we talk about life itself as a pilgrimage, I think, as Jyotish presented so wonderfully in this allegory, the spiritual path is itself a pilgrimage, although we don't always know it. We come, we are like prodigal sons. We come from God, we have been with God for long, long eons of time. And then, just as in the story of the little bird, we decide to test our own strength. And we decide, gee, I have will. I have an intellect. I can make decisions. I can try this and that. And then we wander away from our home in God. And inevitably, we find ourselves strangers in a strange land. As it says in the parable of the prodigal son, eating that food which was thrown to the pigs. Meaning, living in a way that is so far beneath our station because we have left our home. And the whole of the spiritual path, the whole of life, in fact, is to trace our steps back to our home in God, to that bliss eternal. And as Swamiji said, it can take us a long time or a short time, depending on the purity. Purity means single-minded focus, the single-minded focus of our intentions. And if our intentions are single-minded, then we begin this journey. And when do we begin it? That's an interesting question for each of us to ask ourselves. Because there's a moment, really in time, maybe in this lifetime, maybe many lifetimes ago, when we realize this is not my life. The life I'm living is not what I'm meant to live, like the prodigal son. Maybe it's pain that drives us to that choice. Maybe it's suffering. Maybe it's wisdom when we look around us and say, this world is not what it seems. It's really like water through my hands. I can't grasp it. Or maybe it's devotion, where we say, Lord, I love you more than anything this world can offer. Whatever it is that prods us onto the path, we take that step and we begin the journey. And once that step is taken, it's the turning point of many, many choices, of many lifetimes of experiences, and we go forward. And we begin moving in that direction. But when you look at the world around you, you see there's a choice we make, people make. They either choose to live in this world as tourists or as pilgrims. If we choose to live as a tourist, we stay in that Disneyland. And we want all the experiences. You know, don't you, when we meet someone who's about to go on a big trip. Oh, and look at the brochure, and we're going to go here and here, and we're going to go hang gliding, and we'll have this experience and that, and we're going to eat this kind of food and that. And it's all about what I can experience outwardly, what this body or mind or feelings can experience. And most people live their lives that way, as tourists, strangers in a strange land. But if we choose to live our lives as pilgrims, we begin the quest for the sacred. And then everything, we look for that sacred. And I don't know about you, but we've had the opportunity to be on in many holy sites, and you see people coming, and even though they've taken their body to a sacred place, they're still tourists. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at the art and the architecture and taking pictures of themselves in front of the statue of St. Francis. And even those who begin the path, they're still doing it to some extent as tourists. But we need to understand that once we begin the spiritual journey, every day can be a pilgrimage if we consciously do it as such. Every day when we wake up, we are awakening into God's sacred realm. And the light and the color and the fragrances, every day it's different. And the whispers from eternity, how God is speaking to you, each day is different. And each day it applies to exactly what you need to hear. If we live our lives as pilgrims, if we walk the sacred way that takes us to our ultimate pilgrimage goal, and that's union with God within, because all of life is an inner pilgrimage. I remember some years ago, Ananta was giving a lecture at Spiritual Renewal Week, and he had a wonderful line that we love to share. He said, people say, oh, the spiritual path is so long, it's so long. And he said, it's not long at all. It's about 2.5-3 feet. It's from the base of your spine to the spiritual eye. And that's the journey. But what a journey. Because it's the most subtle of all journeys we will ever take. And it takes everything we have, as Jyotish was describing, to move forward on that journey. And so I'd like to share a bit now. What are some of the aspects of this journey? First of all, it's how consciously we begin it. If we, I know for me, I read the autobiography of a yogi and thought, oh, that's nice. What else? And then I came to Ananda and thought, this is a nice place. Yeah, nice people here. And for me, maybe I was a little slow. I was probably one of the ones who was pushing the carts along, trying to get them up the steps. It was several years before I realized I made a choice. I didn't see it. I just thought I was kind of drifting along with circumstances in my life. But I made a choice. And that choice was to leave everything behind and try to find God. So go back to that first conscious moment when you chose to be on this pilgrimage, this inner pilgrimage, and remember that. Remember your goal. Remember why you started. I remember many years ago when I had my first Kriya initiation with Swami Kriyananda, something told me this was a watershed moment in my life. And I spent the whole week prior in seclusion, silence, fasting. And then when I consciously took Kriya, it was a great blessing. So the extent that we walk the path consciously every day, not, well, next week I'm going on pilgrimage and so this week I can be kind of rude to people. No, no, no. Every day, you walk the path, the inner journey to God. And if we can do it ever more consciously, really that's, if we did only that one thing, we would find God. If we only every day consciously walked as a pilgrim, moving towards God, that would be our exit ticket. But there's so much more we can do as well. Because we're walking along the path, and then what happens? We come to a crossroads, a fork in the road. And that point is the point that makes all the difference in the world. It doesn't happen once, happens over and over again. Which way shall I choose? Which way shall I go? And a friend reminded me recently that Swami liked to share the quote from a Greek tragedy. I don't know which one it was, but if you've read any Greek tragedies, they're pretty rough. The heroes have a rough go of it. But in this one, there was a line that said, when the gods want man to suffer, first he makes them crazy. And so you come to a fork in the road, and you think, wow, look at that, a new car. I think I'm going to work really hard to get a new car, or whatever. And so often, people have told me, you know, I was just about to move to Ananda Village. I had quit my job, given up my apartment, got rid of a lot of my stuff, and that day, the perfect job that I had been waiting for years, or the perfect person walked into my life, just like sent from God. Well, I don't think so. The gods make us crazy. And we think, that might really work. I think I could still be on the path and have this whatever. But it doesn't work. We have to make the right choice. And we have to move in the direction. Many of you know, we had a wonderful experience last November. We went on the pilgrimage to Babaji's cave. Mary is here. She was with us on the trip. And it was a wonderful pilgrimage, but it was also, there were so many lessons I learned. It was on that pilgrimage we had the idea of this theme for Spiritual Renewal Week, because we would come to forks in the road, and often we would just be walking along, and we didn't really know which way do you go here, but Keshava, one of the tour guides, somehow always managed to stay in earshot, and we were at a certain point, and we yelled down, Keshava, which way do we go? And he yelled back, when in doubt, keep going up. And there you have it. When you're not sure, don't go sideways, don't go backwards, and don't go down. Go up. And so when those forks come, take Keshava's advice. Keep going up. And we know what that up is. But the gods make us a little crazy, so we don't want to know what that up is. And you know, on that pilgrimage, it was so wonderful because we came from all over India and we met at a train station in the very early hours of the morning in Delhi. Everyone was kind of bleary-eyed. Everyone had all sorts of suitcases and luggage, and we were trying to find the right, you know, place to get board the train and so forth. And it was just like the first days of Ananda, where people came, you didn't really know them, but they were sort of the same interest that you had the same interest. And little by little, at first it was loud and chaotic, and we think, oh my God, this is a pilgrimage? But then little by little, people got their stuff all put away, and it became quiet. And then by the next day, we began the conscious climb. And so it's like that. The choices branch out before us. And people give us advice, but we think, oh no, they don't know. And you know, and it's because of our karmic tests. People, maybe you're saying, have a choice in front of you, and you ask advice of someone you trust, and they say, you know, I wouldn't do that if I were you. And you think, oh, you don't understand. And then you ask another person, and they say, I wouldn't do that. Oh, they don't understand, and on and on and on and on, until finally one person says, well, if you want to do it, do it. And you think, ah, they understand. But, you know, even it's such, not to take it lightly, because it's such a powerful lesson. You know, masters, I think he was grooming him to be his successor, his disciple Richard Wright. He went with him, you know, his diaries and the autobiography of a yogi. He went with him to India in 1935-36, met Sri Yukteswar, touched his feet. You know the rest of the story? He got back to America. Swami tells it without mentioning names in The New Path. And Richard has passed away, so we can share this story. He said, Master, I have to go to Philadelphia to do something. And Master said, they were in the East Coast, they had just landed. And Master said, you're going to buy a ring for a girl, aren't you? And Richard said, how did you know? And Master said, don't do this. And Richard said, you don't know anything about her. And Master said, I know everything about her. You won't have a day of happiness. Fork in the road, the gods make us crazy, meaning our karma blinds us to the direction we should take. And he went, and he married that woman. And Master said, indeed, he did not know one day of happiness. So be mindful of those forks. The karma, it's there, but we can transcend it. If we keep trying to see clearly. Now, how do we see more clearly? Like tomorrow, our whole talk will be overcoming karma on the path, so we'll just touch it lightly here. But on this trip to Babaji's cave that we took, at first it was sort of gentle up and down for the first half, but then the last half was straight up. And there was one man on the pilgrimage, and this is true, not allegorical. He had a deformed spine and short leg, and I thought, how in the world is he ever going to do this? With cheerfulness, with joy, he made it up to the top and back. I couldn't believe it. He was an older Indian man, but so much did he want to make that journey that he did that. And so how can we overcome the karma as we move along? How do we find the strength of purpose? Well, for one thing, I find it helpful to walk with people who are a little faster than I am, who are a little stronger than I am, and it keeps me going. If they can do it, I can do it. We'll keep doing it. We'll keep doing it. And if you walk alone, to find your own spiritual rhythm, to find the strength within yourself that you just don't stop, you keep going, I can overcome this karma. And you keep moving forward. And you keep saying, whatever comes, I have the strength to overcome it. And it just as when we reached Babaji's cave, I was a spent force. I was exhausted. But we sat down there. The blessings were unbelievable because we had all made that journey. And it wasn't easy for anybody, but we did it. And it was symbolic of saying, however hard this is, we're not going to stop. We're not going to go back to the bus and wait in the bus while other people are making the trip up. And that's what the tourists do. They go back to the bus and wait. And so then there are pitfalls along the way, too. When we were coming down, our tour guides, Diane Keshava, said, there'll be an older woman at a little farmhouse, true, and she'll offer you tea. Don't take it. Our pilgrims have taken it last time. It's not sanitary and everybody gets sick. And so there are little things along the way that, oh, this will make it easier. Have a nice cup of tea. Take some time off. Go easy on yourself. Beware. Just keep going. And then finally, the determination to say, I am not quitting, no matter what. Maybe I'll make it to the goal, and it won't be what I thought. Maybe I'll make it to the goal, and they won't let me in because I'm not ready. It doesn't matter, because it's an inner journey. Anandi just shared with me this wonderful article, and please don't ask me because I'm leaving and I don't have time to get it to you, but it was the story of Andy Lyon. Many of you remember him. He was called Gone Hiking. Andy was a young man, true story, all this, who came to Ananda. I don't remember the first year he came. He was in his early 20s. When this article was in Backpacker magazine. You can maybe do some searching and find it. When he was 19 in college, Andy was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And they were able to do chemo and different treatments, and it looked like it was gone. And then 2 years later, it was come back way widespread. They did more treatment, bone marrow transplants, all sorts of things. Looked like he was okay. 6 months later, more widespread. Diagnosis, terminal cancer, 2 years to live. So what did Andy decide to do? He decided to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. He said, if I've got 2 years, okay, let's use it. And he said, why am I doing this? Because I want to show that I'm stronger than the cancer. And that cancer is an allegory for our karma. He was determined, and he didn't tell anybody on the trail that he had terminal cancer, that it was growing at a very rapid rate in his body. He just set off, a young man, to hike the almost 3,000 miles from Mexico up to Canada. And people in good shape have a hard time with that journey. And he met many wonderful people. He told no one and what he was doing, but he had that determination. Sometimes he had to take time off. He'd fly back to his parents' home in Laguna Beach, but then get back on the trail. And then finally, he'd made it very far. And he was up in Washington, Yakima, Washington. And the tumors were growing so fast that they were pressing on his spine. And he was starting to lose feeling in his legs. He couldn't walk. So he was crawling. He was crawling on the trail. And then finally some people came by and he said, I think you better take me to the hospital. So they took him to the local hospital in Washington. And it was a small town, a small hospital. But they were one of 90 hospitals in the country that had this new drug that shrinks tumors, a new chemo drug. And he said, give it to me. And so he took it, the tumors shrank enough. I mean, it wasn't curative. It was, maybe it would give him a couple of weeks. The story got out, people joined him, and Andy finished that walk. He made it to Canada, and he said it was simply about proving I could overcome anything. 10 months later, he came to Ananda with his mother and sister. They were at the Crystal Hermitage guest house. And 4 days later, Andy passed away. But that is an inner pilgrimage. Andy did it for us, not only for himself. He did it to show us that there's nothing that can stop us on this journey if we say, I am stronger than any adverse circumstances. And this is our path. Don't get discouraged. Whatever happens, just if you're crawling on your hands and knees, you do that. And help will come. And a miraculous drug that doesn't exist anywhere else will be there for you so that you can finish your journey. And that's God's grace. If when God sees there's nothing that's going to stop this person, not bewildering forks in the road, not steep uphill climbs, not adverse karma. When God sees there's nothing that will stop us, that grace comes, and he said, we will finish together. And Andy left us that legacy. And so, as we started off saying, Walker wrote many books, and one of the last books he wrote was about a pilgrimage. And it was the pilgrimage to Guadalupe. I read from the first chapter of The New Path, and I'll just close with the last page from A Pilgrimage to Guadalupe. And the pilgrim says, I see now that there was no pilgrimage to be made, no goal to be reached. I turned and rejoicing to my companion, he was walking with an older man, and to my amazement saw there not a slightly cynical, furrowed-browed man, but a young girl smiling at me radiantly, the Virgin of Guadalupe. And all the people you've met along this journey have been aspects of your own self, she told me. I myself am an aspect of your own self. I am the motherhood of God. I embrace the universe. I am the source of your own being. From me alone, you draw the very power to breathe, to think, to create. Without me, you could do nothing. Without me, you wouldn't exist. And so, everyone we meet on this journey, from Master to Swamiji, to our Guru Bhais, who I know you feel as I do, a great honor to walk this path with such souls as all of you. Everyone is just an aspect of your own self. Everything you experience is some alignment of consciousness within your own self. That's all it is. And when we get the secret, when we see behind the veil, we realize there's nowhere to go, but we rest like the prodigal son returning in the eternal bliss of our own nature. God bless you.